You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. And welcome to 2022's World Tour with Vasim Khan's The Dying Day. Chapters Dying Day. 1 to 15. Herds, it's good to have you back.
Flex, it's good to hear your lovely voice. I haven't been in contact with you for a little while due to real life excitement and circumstances.
I know.
It's good to be back on the show with you for another year. I think it's going to be the best one yet.
No, I'm really glad we're starting with this book, continuing our venture into Indian historical fiction.
It certainly helps that it's a good book.
We wrapped up with the absolutely incredible Murder in Old Bombay by Nev March.
Yes.
And then we are doing Vasim Khan's The Dying Day this time. I also read the prequel book, Midnight at Malabar House, in preparation for this, but we won't be talking too much about it. We won't spoil anything that The Dying Day doesn't already spoil itself.
I was going to say, there are definitely some spoilers.
Yes.
Shout out to Fernandez. No, I'm very excited to continue our journey through Indian crime fiction, because I definitely wasn't expecting to be here on doing like research into particularly the police in India. It makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of good crime fiction over there.
Yep.
But this journey kind of started for me when I covered the waiter last year as part of an interview, and then Murder in Old Bombay, and now this, and it's been great. It's been a really good time.
Yeah, so let's kind of get into the gritty of things here. The Dying Day is the second venture of Persis Wadia. It takes place just days after the prequel Midnight at Malabar House.
Yes.
A real copy of Dante's Inferno that was abandoned in India by an academic during one of many uprisings before the British pulled out of India. And that's a real thing that still exists there. We mentioned that with Vasim Khan at the end of last year's show. It goes missing. One of the scholars that was studying it basically runs off with it, leaves a King James Bible in its place.
Of course he does.
And we're now on the trail of it with many a riddle to tide us along the way.
Goodness. We're on the trail of something. Can I say, I, as a good murder mystery puzzle solver, I did in fact pause the book in order to solve that riddle, the first riddle that we found. And I was disappointed, a little disappointed that I wasn't able to actually solve it this week, because I managed to do it by the end of the chapter it's presented in, which I actually really enjoyed. I thought it was a very well put together riddle.
Yeah.
Beg with two G's is a great clue. So I loved that one.
Yeah. I also think it's really, really endearing how much Vasim Khan like teaches Indian history in his riddles.
Yes.
I have really enjoyed while trying to figure these out, all of the things I am learning in the process.
Oh my goodness. I'll tell you what we can talk about. The at the very opening of the book, there is in fact a riddle.
Yes.
Hold on. Let me grab the riddle.
I've got it up if you want me to just read it.
I don't care. I want to read it. Once the seat of kings refined, from whence an empire was defined, lost in war and invasion bold, dismembered piece by piece for gold and precious stones of countless hue, rara aves among the Serlicue. It lives on now in myths of yore, sought in vain forevermore.
Now, hang on a minute. I don't think hang on a minute. No. We're not continuing yet.
What?
That's the riddle for before the story begins for you.
Yes.
Mine's different.
You have a different one?
I have a different
one. What do you mean
you
have a different riddle? Oh, no.
Mine is a spectral presence at water's edge that Greeth is twisted by sovereign's pledge. Twixt walls of snow lie lovers past, neath stony crown by masons cast.
Wait.
Dude.
What? Hold, we need to research this between episodes. Because I figured mine out, I believe. There's no answer on the website. Mine, I believe, is the peacock throne, which was taken in a Persian invasion.
Oh my God.
And basically just taken apart by the Persians and such.
This is so exciting. I was going to leave this for you to solve. And now
there's
we have one
each. Second riddle?
We have one each.
Well, I've already put my answer forward. So a peacock throne is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But if you want to solve yours, go right ahead.
I'll have to get back to you. I wasn't ready for this.
I wasn't ready for this either. This is great.
I'm startled.
This is very strange.
What a fun twist. Well done, Vasim Khan.
What a twist! Anyway, back to the book. But anyway, I guess that's kind of the fun thing, though, that we'll get into as the book goes on, is that Vasim Khan is teaching us things about history, about the peacock throne, about whatever the heck riddle you've got, about, you know, Sinan, the architect, the ultimate architect, and George Wittet, who built the big gate that I forget the name of. Look, point is, his riddles are all about historical figures who must have existed before 1950 and that anyone in the modern age can solve relatively easily without having to go to a geography expert because we have the internet. So he has to build these riddles in such a way that we can solve them, but also that it's not too easy. You can't just look up the name of a person and figure it out. And he's got a good sense, I think, of how to direct us towards interesting historical events and figures, and also keeping a good element of whimsy in there, I think is the other thing I want to highlight.
Well, the other interesting thing that I did want to point out about the riddles here is that I suppose, as the cover of my edition of the book implies, it's definitely got a few nods to the Da Vinci Code in here. I haven't read the Da Vinci Code in years. I do plan to finish it before next week's show, but I remember that the solution to that book was a bit of a meme. The main riddle of that book is notoriously simpler than the book pretends it is.
Interesting.
And I think that Vasim has done an incredible job of making a well-balanced riddle, as you imply, that's very easy to find if you go digging for it, but doesn't like...
It doesn't jump out at you.
...spill off the page automatically.
No. I definitely think that's the trick. Especially... I mean, I wish we could just talk for hours about this, but like I've been on the internet. I've seen some of the ARGs that people play around, you know, certain media releases. There was a very infamous example of a playable trailer.
Yes.
It's called PT, playable trailer, that came out, and the developers expected the ARG would take at least a week to solve, and people solved it overnight when it was released. And it's just a very simple walk-through corridors horror game, but the solution involved speaking into the microphone in your PlayStation controller and saying, "Jareth," to your empty room, presumably, when nothing else in the game had indicated that you would have to actually speak into the controller. It was insane. It was insane. Yeah. But the internet at this point, you know, you put a riddle out there, you have to expect that it'll be solved within 24-hour period.
Yes, I assume that the competition that is listed at the start of these books did not last long.
No, I assume so as well, yeah.
But yeah, I suppose let's jump into the story proper. So Persis Wadia, I think one of the most interesting things about her as a character for this book is that her father is a bookshop owner. There is a really fantastic quote in the previous book, which I won't read directly, because I don't want to take the joy away from you, but the way that her father is characterized really, I think, lends itself to why she is the perfect detective for this book. You know, she has her interests in literature and history and learning, and despite being, I guess, what some would consider the stereotypical nerd through that, is still an absolute go-getter powerhouse and the first female policewoman in India in this fictionalized version of events.
She's great how, like, no-nonsense she is. She does occasionally bite her tongue, so to speak, but it's very rare, and it's always in, you know, like, in service of the investigation.
Yes.
She is absolutely a nerd, and I love that. Nerds unite. And I don't know, I really appreciate her presence. And of course, being the first female police inspector gives Vasim Khan an excellent lens to view the police force through and to view, you know, like, I remember one of the moments that kind of stuck out to me was how she keeps getting asked, "So what's it like being the first female police inspector? How cool is that?"
She's like, the next person that asks me, I will punch them.
Yeah, she's like, it's like I'm an animal in the zoo. This is awful. This is degrading. Like, ugh. It's just so frustrating that people can't just accept it and move on.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that they point out at the start of this book is that the previous one had her basically being subverted by someone else who was working alongside her, who was feeding information to the press, hoping that she would fall on her own sword. And that obviously didn't go according to plan.
Someone that she admired, someone she looked up to, such is the folly of humans.
And
I'd say.
I really like, I think we've only really gotten the beginnings of it as of chapter 15, but they're forced to work together again in this book on the case of a woman who was found with her legs cut off on a train track in the city.
I was going to say,
you know, obviously in a murder mystery, it's going to end up being relevant somehow, though we're not quite clear on what yet. But I really like the way that it's such a powerful note for those two characters that it feeling like a B plot doesn't really matter because their working dynamic is so interesting. you know, you get a very authentic sense of like the ingrained misogyny that her coworker has, and Persis just inability to let him take charge in what is his case.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, as a reader, it's so easy to side with her because so often she is right and her decisions make sense. But other times she's just headstrong.
Yeah, there's definitely a big part of the story that is propped up by the character drama between those two individuals, the Sherlock and possible Watson. It's kind of hard to define their exact relationship. But also between her and her family, I think that is definitely part of what makes this novel work, that we're not just dealing with dry old dusty tombs.
Yeah.
There's the geographer, I believe, says, I like to get my hands dirty and look at the marble and, you know, really get in there with an archaeological kit. And it's like, if we did that for the whole novel, it'd get stale. So definitely having these characters with very strong opinions about, you know, what's acceptable in the workplace, what's acceptable in the home life, what's acceptable in a murder case, you know?
Yeah.
And to your point, we get a lot of internal monologue from Persis, and she thinks a lot about how whenever she's berating this officer for stupid decisions he's making,
yes,
she'll often think, I'm not going to say that I also had that thought before I quashed it because it was a stupid idea. Yeah. Like, she's made the same mistake that he's making, she just didn't say it out loud. Which I think is a very interesting piece of characterization for her, for sure.
Yeah, I think the other thing that's interesting there, you mentioned that Fernandez has kind of become the Watson in this situation.
Yeah.
And we do have a couple of other, you know, like Huck and Burlow, who are basically like the police station's thug characters.
I mean, all we know about them, let me tell you, I've written down just very short summaries of all the characters.
Before Ben says this, I should say that they are even less present in the previous novel.
Great. All we know is that they were at a stadium, like, quelling riots or something. Yeah. So I've written them down as detectives and toughs, as their, like, two, like, code words that I associate with them, which is great, alongside Fernandez, the scummy detective, and Akbar, the Persian cat.
But the interesting thing, though, is that Archie Blackfinch, Archimedes Blackfinch, if you will.
Uh-huh, Archimedes.
Who very much feels like a side character in this book, was kind of like main Watson of the last book. And it's been really interesting seeing him switch into this other role where he's now teaching another person how to do his job, because that's ostensibly why he's in India.
Sure.
And I kind of liked that these two characters, Persis and Archimedes, who were a great duo in the previous book, are now both having to learn to work with other people, and that's keeping their own Watson duo apart. It hasn't, like, it's paid off yet in this story, but I'm really looking forward to what we get of it as we go further in.
I feel like it's more Persis having to learn to work with new people, because Archie brings his student, I believe?
Yes.
Muhammad Akram. But he brings him on to work when they come to the tomb of George Wittet, which is the whole thing.
Yes.
And Persis is like, but why can't I work with you? And he's like, well, because I might not always be here.
Yeah.
Which is some ominous foreshadowing.
It's anyway. It's very interesting. I'm really excited to get into that. Anyway, we should wrap this part of the discussion here. We're going to talk a little bit more about the mysteries and the riddle as we come back towards the end of the show. You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are discussing chapters 1 to 15 of Vasim Khan's The Dying Day. This is 2SER 107.3. Stick around. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex here. And hey, I just wanted to jump in before we continue with today's discussion on The Dying Day with just a short bit of housekeeping for Death of the Reader this year. You may have caught on at the end of last year, we had a few guests on, including but not limited to Jim Noy of The Invisible Event, Sean Britton of 2SER, now X2SER, as the case may be, solving mysteries here with us on the show, and we wanted to do a bit more of that this year. So if you are a mystery reader, mystery writer, mystery blogger, someone who has some interesting things to say about a piece of text, or just love a challenge, up at 2SER.com/deathoftheReader with a hyphens in between each of those last four words, you can find our contact details to get in touch with us and let us know if you want to be involved with the show, we'd love to have you on, solve some murder mysteries, talk about this fun stuff. We don't have a heap of slots available for the year, but jump in while you can, and we'd love to have your expression of interest. Again, that's 2ser.com/deathoftheReader with hyphens in between each of the last four words, or you can go to the schedule page with the link in the top right of the 2ser.com homepage and find us that way. We're going to jump back into The Dying Day with Vaseem Khan in just a second. You're on 2SER 107.3. This is your Murder Mystery World Tour. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Hertz here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. We are discussing Vaseem Khan's The Dying Day, a historical Indian novel set in the 1950s, just after the British exit proper from India. And Hertz, we were having a good fun discussion about the characters in the story that we've been introduced to, some of the fun holdovers from the previous novel, Midnight in Malabar House, which is also great fun, but we aren't talking about in depth today.
We couldn't.
But Hertz.
It's okay. I haven't read it.
We had a bit of a moment earlier on the show today where we realized that our books have different riddles at the start of them before the story begins. And which is great fun, and we'll talk about that hopefully with Vaseem Khan in the coming weeks. I don't know. We're recording this ahead of time because
we'll find out in the future past.
But yeah,
that's how it is. Yeah.
But I think the fun thing about these riddles, as we mentioned, is that they're really well balanced and do a good job of teaching history as well as being engaging.
Mm.
And I think the fun thing that carries across from that into the regular mystery side of the story is that Vaseem Khan is doing an incredible job of setting a mystery scene while making it feel like a regular scene, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Like, we walk into John Healy, our victim and the guy who stole Dante's Inferno's apartment, and it's very clear, at least to me from the way he describes it initially, that it's in disarray, but our characters don't quite notice it the first time they're there.
Sure.
So we have a really good sense that someone else is also on Healy's trail. You know, it's kind of to be expected in this kind of novel, but I really enjoyed that and a few other scenes where we visit certain locations and Vaseem Khan very explicitly omits details to the characters, but not to us. And I really enjoyed how, maybe subtle isn't the word, but gentle those gentle. Inclusions were. Yeah.
I suppose so. I definitely do like the fact that the characters don't, like, obviously it's clear by this, but we've had the autopsy of the last found on the train tracks, which is an absolute classic place to find a corpse in these books. And I guess that's part of your point, I suppose. We know that she was murdered, but it's not 100% treated as a murder case. It's treated as a suicide initially. Like, that's kind of what they're expecting. Even the cops who are in charge, we don't get their names, but the cops who are like in charge of the scene, they're not really treating it with any particular respect.
Yeah, it basically gets sent to the Malabar House police station where these characters work because it's considered so unimportant. And they're like the dirt of the Indian police force.
Well, I think it was also because it is a white woman who is found dead. And that is a political thing, with the British having recently, you know, packed up from Bombay and all that, or Mumbai, as might also been known. And nobody wants to hold that particular grenade.
Yes.
So they put it in the book.
I think nobody holding particular grenades, that line definitely is like the carryover theme of so many things that happen in this series.
I can imagine. I think that Malabar House is not just set up as, you know, this is what we said, all the misfits we don't know what to do with.
Mm.
It's also what we send the people who, if they got fired because they handle a case poorly, or because they have to put someone behind bars who is like, I don't know, a Raj or something.
Yeah. Good riddance to them.
Well, yeah, like whatever, no big loss. They're a loose cannon anyway. I like that setup a lot, truthfully. I think it's a really unique place to kind of start with the drama of the murders.
Yeah.
Not that we necessarily know that's what's going on at the start of the book.
I suppose the first mystery-related question I have to ask you before you lay out to us anything you want to cover with the riddles is, with the death of this white woman on the train tracks, she's found with an RAF pin. Do you have any guesses as to where that might be leading and how it may coincide within the Healy case?
Hold on now. It's the POW camp. Okay, so it's the RAF White and Crest, but whatever the Latin phrase is on that is the same as the Greek phrase that Healy put in the James Bible.
Yeah, we did have that link.
It's the exact same thing. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be real with you. I think that whoever that badge belonged to was probably in the same POW camp as Healy. Yeah. And I think that what probably happened in the history of this, because this is a historical novel,
yeah,
is that there was like a couple, or maybe just one, Ralph Whiten soldiers in this Italian POW camp.
Yeah.
And Healy was there too, and a bunch of people were there. And they basically formed a bond, and I reckon they've hidden something. It's either something to do, like, this is the part that I'm not sure, like, what's being hidden here. I'm gonna probably guess Italian gold, mm-hmm. but I don't know.
I mean, I should say, I can't name the book specifically because I don't want to spoil it, but it's starting to sound a little Sherlockian, this theory.
Maybe. I wasn't going to say Sherlockian. I would have mentioned a book that cannot be named, but there's definitely some, like, treasure. That's, like, my immediate thought, is that there's some treasure that all these POW boys and such, they decided to, like, keep hidden.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess a Tontine just because that's... I've got Simpsons on the brain. Shout out to the Hellfish. But I reckon that John Healy is, like, running away and trying to get smart people to find him who know books, because whoever this person is, who's, like, rummaging through his stuff and chasing him, is a part of that group, like POW group. And they're also trying to get their hands on the treasure. And so in this theory, he stole the Dante's book so that people would be forced to come after him and hopefully either find him before this other person did, or make sure that this other person doesn't get a hold of the big treasure at the end, the national treasure or whatever.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say that he's trying to outrun someone, because one of the last things we've seen is his corpse. So why did he stop running, or was he made to stop running by whoever was after him?
I would assume that either... I don't think that he was caught. Like, right now, I subscribe to the suicide theory because the door was bolted to the inside. That said, I don't know if we looked inside the coffin. I don't know if that was a thing, which really annoys me if that was not the case. That frustrates me.
I mean, it's the kind of thing that, yes, I, as a reader, also went, ah, god damn it, why didn't you open the coffin? But it's unsurprising fictionally.
Yes. So in my mind, it is entirely possible, because there's the bolt behind the door, so obviously it's made to look like nobody went in or out. He died on his own, but it's very easy to hide someone in a coffin. Mm-hmm. They're people size for a reason. So either there's someone hiding in the coffin, in which case they're using the police to, like, find this treasure, or perhaps to find the copy of Dante there.
Yeah.
Or the Divine Comedy, I think, is probably the best shorthand. Or he did murder himself, in which case it's probably more to do with the fact that he's been sitting there for 4 days and he's, like, given up hope of being found or such and so forth.
Oh, you reckon he was, like, taking sleeping pills just to bide the time and was hoping he would actually be met by someone?
I mean, maybe he was like, I'll camp out for a couple days, see if someone shows up. Oh no, it's been 3 days and I've got no food or water. I'm just gonna, you know, off myself.
It seems a little extreme. He wasn't that far outside the city.
He wasn't. But yeah, that part I'm less sure of. But clearly he's either killed himself or someone has killed him. I would not be surprised by a they were hiding in the coffin situation.
Yep.
But if he's killed himself with sleeping pills, I think it was more of a I don't know how long I'm gonna have to wait. I'd rather this secret, like, go with me to my grave than I be caught and have it beaten out of me by whoever's on my tail. This, you know, presumably ripped POW individual who's chasing me. That'd be my guess.
Yeah, you seem pretty locked in on the link between these two cases, so I won't really press you there.
That's the strongest part of my theory. It's just figure out why the Divine Comedy is in the book, is the part that I'm, like, stuck on, because I want it, like, obviously that's the prize of the book that we're chasing after, but also why did he take the book if that was the prize? Like, why not just leave it with the society?
Yeah.
I do have theories relating to that we might discuss in the future, but
I hope so. That's what we have to do.
It's true. We do. But, there might be reasons why you want to get away from the society itself and away from certain people.
Alrighty. Now, Herds. Last year, for our third year of the show, we did a triple or nothing game. There was suggestions that we were going to do a quadruple or nothing game this year. You're down.
Quadruple or nothing. Those are the biggest stakes
yeah.
that we've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
Quadruple or nothing. It almost makes the past 3 years mean nothing.
Well, I mean, when the stipulation is that someone goes to zero, we have to give them a means to catch up.
Oh, you're right. Fair enough. You know what? I'm with you.
The game wouldn't work if we didn't keep raising the stakes.
The game wouldn't work if we didn't keep raising the stakes to make the previous year not matter at all.
Anyway,
you're absolutely
with you
correct.
At zero, yep. mm-hmm. with you at zero now, Herds.
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess I sure. will. I will award you a point for posing a theory this week, as we continued okay. with last year.
Oh, is that enough for a theory? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. I reckon I'm happy with that, Link. If you want to make some more firm predictions, I can perhaps toss a second point your way.
Okay, well, if that's enough for a point, then I would have put it on the table that Forrester is suspicious as heck. She's got big Amogus energy, and I don't like her very much.
You're telling me that the ruthless single lady who runs the society is suspicious in some way?
A little bit. Can I tell you that I'm surprised...
Why were you never remarried? It's yeah, because well. I'm so normal and I'm not going to
yeah, I mean,
be a cold, emotionless killer at the end of this tale.
I definitely need to go back through all the times that we've like spoken with her and people have spoken about her. But yeah, people have been like, I made advances on her and she was really cold and da-da-da-da-da.
I mean, to be fair, you know, Persis is a single lady
who seems to
brush off advances. So are you saying that Persis is a cold,
foil.
Ruthless killer?
No, makes her a great foil for our main character.
Okay.
Anyway. But the thing that I'm surprised you haven't put forward immediately is that, well, if John Healy is trying to keep the clues away from, you know, he wants smart people to figure it out,
mm-hmm.
then why would he leave the King James Bible somewhere where Forrester could get access to it? But as we all know, she literally fumbled the first clue.
Yes.
She fumbled the ball immediately. So... I would wager that he left the clue, the Greek phrase of follow the truth or follow Alice.
Yes.
Knowing that A, she would be too hung up on her own public image to seek help in that regard. And also that she is not an expert in Greek nuance. She's a very like brass tacks history kind of lady.
Before we wrap up, I did love the scene where she goes to get the Greek retranslated and the guy's like, do you see what I'm reading here?
Yeah.
Do I look like an expert to you?
it's a pretty great scene. Well, he literally retranslates it in front of her. He's like, it's a very easy mistake to make.
Yeah, yeah.
You can just smell her fuming.
It's so
anyway.
Good. Anyway,
yep.
The reason I raised the quadruple or nothing game, Herds, both because it's the first episode of the year.
Uh-oh.
But also because I have a challenge for you.
Oh, no.
In chapter 19, we are presented our next riddle.
Oh, good.
I want you to stop at that point, solve the riddle, and then alert me when you think you're ready. We can record a short coverage of your interpretation and then press on with the following chapters so that you get the chance to actually solve a riddle on the show rather than being subverted.
I was so disappointed. I was like, yo, can I actually, you know what I need to tell you about? Rather than talking about the riddle that actually matters, I spent far too long trying to figure out what the second,
Dante's,
I guess,
the opening lines of the Divine Comedy.
Yes, the opening lines of the Divine Comedy. I read them and was like, halfway through life, came to myself a dark wood. Is this like a river? I spent like 20 minutes maybe looking up rivers and trying to figure out if there was like a mirrored lake or something or a specific wood. It was insane. I found there's a lot of temples on the banks of rivers,
yeah.
By the way, just so you
yeah,
know that.
Yeah.
Anyway, in Bombay.
Let's
anyway.
let's get to it. So you're going to solve that riddle in chapter 19, alert
sure.
me to it, and then our next episode proper will be up to and including chapter 31. So 16 to 31 for next week, but we'll take a pause at 19 for you in the middle of the week, Herds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can slot that
and
in
I hope you enjoy that one. I think you'll have fun with it.
I'm enjoying it.
I'm going to put 2 points up for grabs on that riddle in particular.
Ooh.
But I should be clear that the second point will be for extrapolating on the riddle itself. So be ready to...
So it's not enough to say, it's in the Surrey Cemetery. I have to say, like, it's under the lion statue in the corner underneath. Is that what you mean?
Pretty much. I think you'll be able to get this one. I was able to figure it out narrowly. I had a bit of help from Dr. Google.
Of course. I mean, how else am I supposed to not learn about Indian history, if not through Google?
But I believe in your ability. So that'll be our stretch for next week. I hope you've enjoyed the return of Death of the Reader for 2022. I'm very excited to press on with this book. It's been a great way to start the year.
Look, I've really enjoyed hanging out with Vasim Khan, getting a look inside his brain. It's been great. I just don't tell anyone how much Wikipedia I've been using in my research, because it would make my English teacher cry. They would not be happy.
I'm excited to get to it. 16 to 31 next week on the show. This is Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour here on 2SER 107.3. And we'll see you next week.